This is Main Street on Prairie Public. I'm Doug Hamilton. Thanks for joining us for our radio Main Street across North Dakota this time of day. We stream live at the same time at prairiepublic.org. And, of course, the shows are archived after their broadcast as podcasts at the same place. And on Fridays, before the second Sunday of the month, we always chat with Jack Russell Weinstein, the host of Why, Philosophical Discussions About Everyday Life, because his show is this Sunday at 5 Central. And Jack, thanks for joining us.
I am happy to be inside, if nothing else.
Now, your topic this week is, does it make sense to blame the system? That's a wide-open question.
It is, and the guest and I were a little concerned that it would be too abstract, but it actually wasn't. I mean, here's a problem. You're trying to get in touch with Verizon customer service.
Yeah.
And you get that automated voice, press 1, press 2, press 3, and you're doing it over and over and over again. Why are they doing it? Is it to be efficient? Is it to slow you down? Is it to get you to hang up and just not ask the question in the first place? These are the kind of questions that we ask when we want to blame the system, when there's no individual to focus on. Does it make sense to do that? That was the focus.
And you wanted to talk with whom about this?
Lisa Herzog. Lisa is a younger academic who I met many years ago and who has had a volcanic career doing really interesting things. But she was also in the Netherlands. So she herself is German, but she has a university professorship in the Netherlands. And so it was this multi-international, long-distance conversation. It was fun.
So what is her take on does it make sense to blame the system?
Well, she starts off by talking about the system, but then focuses on how individuals work together, both in terms of people's actions, but also procedures, right? That there are moral ways to do things and immoral ways. And she tells this great story, and it really helped me understand what she was getting at very quickly. She said there's a young doctor named Monica who is working in a hospital, and she's very, very, very concerned about her patients and doing the best job she can and super focused and super moral and wants everyone to be happy and healthy. And so she comes in every day and looks at the doctor at the charts that the doctors had written before, and all of the doctors had written illegibly. She couldn't read the notes, or she could, but she had to work very, very carefully to do so. And this stressed her out completely, because if she made a mistake, the mistake could be at worst deadly, but certainly make people suffer, not give them the best care. This is the kind of thing she focuses on. Is it a moral imperative to write legibly? Of course it is. But that's not the kind of thing that any of us thinks about, taking notes and passing it on to the next person. So what Lisa likes to do, and she likes to look at the way that people and procedures interact together in order to investigate how we can have a better, more just, more equal, and progressing system.
Okay. Well, I was recently in a doctor's office, and the doctor spent about 5 or 10 minutes trying to get the computer to work.
and this actually – I've been really frustrated with this because, of course, I just turned 50, so I've been at the doctor quite a bit. And they're always looking at the computer, and they're not looking at you, and it's very frustrating. You feel like you are a machine in this larger, you know, apparatus, but – part of what they're doing is solving this problem, right? If it's on the computer and it's standardized, then all of the people who are engaging in care know exactly where to go for the information, know exactly how to read it, and know how to pass it on successfully to other people. One of the wonders of the modern world, I mean, I'm sure you remember when you were younger as well, you would walk to the doctor, they'd give you a folder, and you'd carry the folder to the other person. And if the folder got lost, they'd lose your records. And now you have access to everything. And so the ethical implications of that are tremendous, because on the one hand, it dehumanizes you because
yes,
you are just a procedural person. On the other hand, at least in theory, it increases the standard of care to such a degree that it improves it massively. And so how do you balance those two things?
Okay. Well, you just offered an example when we started this conversation about a phone system, a cell phone company. I had an interaction with a cell phone company about a service I wanted to end, and it required 2 one-hour conversations. That struck me as a system that was dysfunctional.
Well, it is and it isn't, right? It's dysfunctional from your perspective, but it's not dysfunctional from their perspective because they want to keep charging you, right? This is part of the underlying, I guess you'd call rationality, the logic of the system, right? Who are they catering to? So let's take a step back for a second. Very famously, it's impossible as an individual to get in touch with Facebook customer service. You can send them emails, you can fill out forms, but you can't call anybody because they aren't interested in your business. They're only interested in data information and working with large scale companies and all of that sort of stuff. Same thing with a cell phone carrier, right? They are interested in income, but not cutting that income. So some vice president somewhere said, let's have this bureaucratic way that they have to go through, these hoops they have to go through in order to make it hard for them to cancel their subscriptions or their services or whatever. And so a lesser person, Doug, a lesser person would just give up. A lesser person would continue paying the $3 a month or the $8 a month each month for the next 5 years, and Verizon or whomever would make the money.
Well, here's another example. It's the cable company. When you sign up for the cable service, they bring it all in. They connect it all up. They double check it and they shake your hand and they're gone. And when you want to end the service, you have to disconnect it, bring it to them, and make sure you brought it all in the right container.
That's right, because of course it's all designed, right? I mean, in their defense, they've got, you know, 5 million customers or something, and every day they get, you know, in the mail 5,000 modems that are returned, and they want it all in such a way that they can make sense of it and organize it. But here's the problem, and I actually didn't use this line with Lisa, and I probably ought to have. In the heart of UND's most difficult moments, a colleague of mine said, part of the issue is it's impossible to tell the difference between being evil and being incompetent, right? And so and so you when you look at the cable company not being able to solve your problem, or the cell phone company not being able to cancel your subscription, it is impossible as an outsider to know, are they doing it on purpose or is there something wrong in the system? And you can be a cynic like me and you can say, oh, they're all out to get the money, right? Or you can be more realistic and say, well, it's a huge corporation, things go wrong. And so again, what Lisa is trying to do is manage this on the smaller level so that we can, I don't know, extend our analysis larger and larger and larger, because when you look at a major corporation, a major organization, you ask, who do you blame? You can't blame the operator. The operator that you're talking to, the customer service person, doesn't make decisions. They have a script to follow.
Yes.
I know that when I have a tech problem with my computer, I'm pretty good at computers. I've done some building of some parts of computers, and I know what my way around it. And so if I have to call tech support, they'll go on this script, and I'll say, look, stop looking at the script. I know what I'm talking about. Here is the thing that you need to know, blah, 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 blah. And half the time they'll stop and they'll talk to me like a human being and we'll solve the problem. And half the time they just can't, because they just are reading the script.
Well, you've been using the example of customer service. And all of these companies, these vast corporations now in many cases, emphasize the quality of their customer service. They use words like family, you know. We're part of this big family. And the irony is it's anything but.
That's absolutely right. It's all branding. It's all advertising. There's this thing now. It's called greenwashing. It's a very cool idea. And what it is packaging that is designed to make people think that something is environmental friendly when it's not.
Yeah.
So people will go into the supermarket and they'll see a certain shade of green on a package of some product, and subconsciously they'll think, oh, this is environmentally friendly, when it's not. And there's this whole way that advertisers do that, right? These major corporations, they say they're a family, but they're not a family, because there's this massive power dynamic. I mean, sure, parents have some authority over kids, although as the parent of a 14-year-old, I certainly question who's in charge. But, you know, when the boss can hire you or fire you, when the boss can assess you, the boss has to talk to you in a certain way and respect you in a certain way. And when an employee is talking to the boss or talking to some supervisor, they have to respect and talk to them in a certain way. And so how, I don't know, transparent, how obvious? How written down are these methods? And how much are we bound by the culture of an organization? Again, I'll talk about UND, both because it's my experience and a lot of the listeners are familiar with it. One of the things that happens at UND is that they tend to hire the same type of person over and over again. And if they hire the same type of person, that type of person is going to make the same mistakes and cultivate the same kind of culture that the other person does. Now, how do you change a culture in a large university? How do you change the culture of Prairie Public? This is all very ambiguous, but it's tremendously important because there are cultures of openness, there are cultures of hostility, there are cultures of respect, there's cultures of making money at all costs, right? One of the things that they've discovered about Wells Fargo Bank in the last few years after all of those scandals is that Wells Fargo was all about making money at all costs.
Yeah, the former CEO has been banned from banking.
That's right. I mean, you know, currently in the world as it is right now, how bad do you have to be banned from banking, right? So, but how do you, as a philosopher, as a sociologist, as an anthropologist, or simply just as an employee, how do you affect not just a particular procedure, but the culture of an organization? And I think that that's a really important way of looking at it because we talk about employees' experience and we talk about procedures and we talk about rules and regulations and we talk about branding and marketing, but all of this is unified by this abstract idea of the culture of something. There's a North Dakota culture that I learned to live in when I moved here. There's a New York City culture that I was born and raised in. And those two things are different. And it took me a while to learn one from the other. And of course, now when I go back to New York, I can adopt that persona. And when I stay here, I can be a certain persona. What happens if I walk into a major corporation? How long does it take me to develop that perspective? How long does it take me to learn not just my job, but how to be a particular kind of person in a particular kind of place? That's what we talk about when we talk about blaming the system. We talk about these abstract ideas that are tremendously important but hard to put your finger on.
Jack Russell Weinstein is the host of Why, Philosophical Discussions about Everyday Life. You can hear it this Sunday at 5 Central on this Prairie Public station. Jack, I'm interested in how Lisa Herzog dealt with the question of, you know, do you roll with the waves or do you make them?
Well, obviously, some of that is contextual, right? Some of that depends on how tenuous your position is, right? I'm a tenured faculty professor, and so I can make a lot more trouble than our administrative assistant, who is an at-will employee. The same is true in other organizations. But ultimately, what she says is that ethics is pervasive, that all of our decisions in all aspects of our life, including our work life, are ethical choices that we have to commit to. So she gives an example of two interviews she did. She doesn't just speculate on the stuff. She did a lot of interviews. And there was this one guy, I think his name was Albert, and he worked in banking in Germany. And she interviewed him, and he came in, and he turned off his phone and his all the stuff. And then he just started talking, she said. And all he kept saying over and over again is that being a banker is immoral. That just you walk into the bank and you have to stop being a person and you have to stop being moral and you have to give in and you just have to completely get sucked in and just do what you have to do. And then she interviewed another person who was in a similar position, and he, again, was sort of talking but a little more reluctantly and saying, look, you have to be very careful because every decision you make is tremendously important and has fabulous ethical implications. And these are two people who have very different outlooks. One person just has given into the system and said, it's not my problem. I'm just going to make money. And the other person is fighting and resisting. And I suspect that on the one hand, the day-to-day life of the person who's concerned with ethics is much harder. But I also suspect that, in the end, that person will be able to sleep at night better.
So if we're part of a system, we either accept the ethical or morality as we perceive it within the system, or we find a new one.
That's right. And sometimes that involves leaving the organization. Sometimes that involves saying, this job is not for me, this workplace is not for me, this office is not for me. And sometimes that involves really pushing and resisting. And of course, one of the things that we all know from being adults is that there are times when you just can't affect change, that you can do the best you can in your own little sphere of influence, but the forces of the world, the forces of the organization, they're just too big. And it feels like bashing your head against the wall. And then you have to choose, do I stay or do I go?
Well, these days, when you go online or when you engage in any kind of contractual relationship with any entity, any system, typically there's a ton of fine print that you're expected to sign off on.
That's right. And this is also one of the ways that the system messes with people, because most people don't know how to read that, don't know what it means. You need to be an expert to understand contracts.
But you'd have to be a corporate attorney to read most of this stuff.
Try reading your credit card agreement, you know, that thing you get in the mail. It's impossible, right? And so on the one hand, right, the lawyers say, well, you've clicked, I agree, on the user terms of use, or you've signed the paper. On the other hand, there are all sorts of things that people put in contracts that are just completely illegal, right? And there are all sorts of things in contracts that can be challenged or just ignored. And so we don't know what that is. And so as we progress into the future, as our systems only become more complicated, this question of how much understanding does an individual person have in order for an agreement to be binding, right? That's incredibly important, because you can certainly make the case, right? And I'm sure some good lawyer will make the case somewhere that the terms of use or some contract that someone signed don't apply because the person just couldn't understand. It's not that they weren't paying attention. It's not that they didn't care. It's that these things were so impossible to understand that the contract is null and void. And it wouldn't surprise me if in the next 5-10 years we see a slew of those lawsuits, because if these things are designed to baffle us, if they're designed to manipulate us without us knowing it, then our status as a person who can sign a paper or commit or be ethical agents, all of that goes out the window.
Well, a long time ago now, argument was made about credit card offerings. And now when you get a credit card, you know, appeal in the mail, and that's pretty much all that you get in the mail these days, there is a simple grid there that says the basic elements of the contract you would engage in, how much interest would be charged, whether there's an annual fee, late fee, you know, all that kind of stuff. We have other arrangements. We use Google every day. We use Facebook every day. And a lot of us do at any rate. And what do we know about what they're doing with what they know about us?
That's absolutely right. So there's two different issues involved in the question that you asked. The first, Lisa and I didn't talk about, but it's something that interests me a lot. It's called the plain language movement. And there's a whole group of people, scholars and lawyers and others, who are really pushing to create things like credit card contracts in everyday understandable language. And there's been some really interesting and good work, also government documents in that sort of thing. And so there's a legend, I've never seen it, of a student who did his doctoral dissertation on the iTunes user agreement and created like a 4-question click box that was the legal equivalent of the iTunes user agreement. But I can't track it down, so I don't know if it's true. At the same time, once you sign those user agreements, there's all sorts of things that people do, right? I mean, we all know now that Facebook tracks our behavior when we're not on Facebook. They put cookies, they put other things on our computers that tell them everything we do. And the argument is, well, you've consented. But have we consented? Have we really knowingly, with full disclosure, accepted this aspect of life? And what's happening ultimately is that we are in such a period of technological change that the technology has outpaced the ethics. And part of what Lisa is trying to do is figure out how the ethics can catch up.
Well, Facebook and Google also argue that they're using these cookies and things to get metadata. Not necessarily specifically about you, but stuff that shows typical behaviors in the, you know, the great pool of people they have to choose from. But we have no guarantee other than an implicit promise, perhaps,
but that's right.
That our IP address will not be tracked and identified as us.
That's absolutely right. And that ultimately is Lisa's point. That's what she means when she says that ethics is pervasive. In the end, either Google is evil, as the saying goes, or it's not. Either Facebook is lying to us or they're not. If they're ethical, if they're honest, if they're keeping to the true standards of what a moral marketplace looks like, then they're telling the truth. But as we know, all of the lawsuits and all of the information suggests that they're just lying to us. And then when you're dealing with a liar, you're dealing with a liar, and you have to sort of decide what to do about that. There are going to be massive class action suits. But right, the thing about class action suits, I've been in a few just by virtue of I bought this, you know, underarm deodorant and then got a letter in the mail. You know, we won $30 million in this class action suit. Here's 17 cents, right? And so once you sort of look at the individual experience of the huge scale of business that we engage in, I don't know how much of a difference it makes. And so we have to update our ethics for a new internet age and a new technological age. But we also have to keep in mind that in the end, this is about person-to-person interaction and the rules of how unequals deal with each other, what it means to respect one another, what it means to tell the truth, what it means to have a motivation to be altruistic, to be empathetic, to be attending to other people's needs. Because in the end, all technology is just a human problem. It's just faster and larger and more complicated.
Well, Coy, here's one more example. In China, of course, they're famously using facial recognition everywhere because they've got cameras everywhere, at least in their major urban areas. This morning, when I looked at my Facebook pages, I was asked by Facebook if I wanted to enable facial recognition. And it said, we won't use this to identify you beyond finding pictures of you that you might want to see. But it's just another step, you know, if the government says, Facebook –
yeah, no, and that's right. I mean, there's been this FBI case for the last couple of years, several cases of the FBI trying to push Apple to create a backdoor for their iPhones, right?
Yeah.
I mean, on the one hand, if it catches some mass murderer, well, that's good. But on the other hand, in order to catch that mass murderer, all of the innocent people have to have their data exposed. That's not the American way. But the other thing is that we talk about China and facial recognition, but the most I don't know what the verb would be, camered city in the world is London,
yeah.
Right? London has more cameras than any other place in the world, and many, many, many highways. I know this in New York State, the New York State Thruway has license plate readers all along the highway, and most people don't know that, right? It's everywhere.
Well, and when I go into the ramp at the Radisson Hotel, it reads my license plate, and it yeah. opens the gate automatically.
Yeah, I mean that's you know, the parking people at UND now, right? You don't even have to have a hanging tag anymore. The computer just knows whether you paid your yearly fee or not. It's insane. And on the one hand, well, okay, it makes life a lot easier. On the other hand, the potential for destruction, the potential for privacy is, you know, it's overwhelming.
This is why we have philosophy, right, Jack?
Well,
the difference between convenience and 1984. Jack Russell Weinstein is the host of Why, Philosophical Discussions about Everyday Life. You can hear his conversation with Lisa Herzog, Does It Make Sense to Blame the System, this Sunday at 5 Central. Jack, as always, thank you.
And I will say that the episode is not nearly as depressing as this conversation.
Very good. Coming up on Main Street, we'll talk with our news director, Dave Thompson, about the week's big stories. And then Matt Olien will review the new movie about Harriet Tubman and make some Oscar predictions because Sunday is Academy Awards night. First, the news.
From the Prairie Public Newsroom, I'm Todd McDonald. North Dakota is once again applying for federal grant money to fund its work training program for older, low-income workers. Officials hope to raise awareness at a time when they say there are many opportunities for folks in this age group. Public comments are being accepted about how the state is administrating the Senior Community Service Employment Program. The evaluation comes as North Dakota hopes to get more funding through 2023. Jackie Seafeld, who runs the Aging Services Program at DHS, says the draft plan includes a variety of jobs that are widely available across the state.
There is a lot that would meet the needs of the, you know, the 55 and plus that aren't, include like the heavy maintenance and a lot of strenuous strength and stuff like that.
The types of jobs include food service and clerical work. North Dakota's labor market information says many of these industries will see growth over the next 5 years as the younger workforce takes up its jobs that require more physical labor. Seifelt says that's possible that many seniors in need of work are not aware that this type of program is available. That's why DHS is hoping the public comment period will generate more interest.
This is a great opportunity that if they aren't workforce ready to get those training needs and to get back into the workforce to improve like their well-being.
To be part of the program, a person needs to be at least age 55, unemployed or not necessarily job ready, and with an income of no more than 125% of the federal poverty level. With Minnesota's 2020 legislative session beginning next week, city leaders in the rural part of the state say water infrastructure and child care are their top priorities. The Coalition of Greater Minnesota Cities wants a bonding bill that would include at least $200 million for water infrastructure. Executive Director Bradley Peterson says unfunded water and sewer projects can slow economic growth in small cities.
There are cities around the state that are in line for these funds if they come through. There are more than 300 Minnesota cities that have critical water infrastructure projects in the works.
Another top priority for the organization is to expand child care programs and to provide bonding money to build new child care facilities in rural communities. And North Dakota Senate Majority Leader is hoping to increase the number of career academies across the state. Those academies are home for career and technical education. They expose high school students to careers that don't take a bachelor's degree and that pay well. Senator Rich Wardner of Dickinson says Governor Burgum is a big supporter of career academies, even talking about it in his recent State of the State address. Wardner says there's a real need in western North Dakota for these kinds of academies, but the needs are also statewide. From the Prairie Public Newsroom, I'm Todd McDonald.
It's Friday. The wire machine is clacking away. It's time to talk with our news director, Dave Thompson, who joins us from our microphone in Bismarck about the week's big stories. And I think one has, frankly, been a story for quite a while and will be
it
for
sure has been, yes.
A couple of months yet. That's the potential for flooding.
All right. I will tell you that there's going to be a flood forecast coming out next week. I was on a webinar with basically the National Weather Service and the Corps of Engineers talking about the Missouri River Basin. There's a lot of concern in the Missouri Basin. But it was interesting because I followed up with Ellen Schlag, who's a hydrologist at the National Weather Service in Bismarck. Said the further east you go, it's still very wet. But you have more frost depth in the Bismarck area and west. And that means there's going to be a lot more runoff there. If you go east, there's going to be a lot more of the water maybe seeping into the ground because the frost depth is not that much. That's good news because the runoff's going to be a little bit less, but it's bad news because more people who have not had water in their basements might get them because the water table is growing. So there's some real double-edged sword stuff going on in terms of the flood outlook.
Of course, the further east you go in the state, too, the flatter it gets.
Flatter it gets, too. That's right.
So,
but it's interesting, as he said, that he was talking to some of the farmers, especially in the James Valley and east, is that, you know, they're still, when they're going out to try to harvest crops, late harvest, you know, December, January, they were hitting mud. And that's the good news, bad news scenario by hitting mud.
Okay. Well, we're having a cold day today, so let's keep our fingers crossed about additional moisture and frost depth.
And that's the good thing about the last 3 weeks. We've had probably less than we've had in terms of moisture, so that's helping. He did predict to me that he thinks that when the forecast comes out, you might see a little bit less of a flood warning. So we'll have to watch that when the forecast comes out next week.
Okay. Well, let's move on to the all-important 2020 census.
Wow.
You went to a We're Counting on You workshop?
Yes, I did. And really, You have 1,200 positions there trying to fill statewide in order to follow up with the census. You know, you answer the census by mail, and if you don't answer it, they're going to come knocking at your door. What they want is North Dakotans to talk to North Dakotans. That's why they've got 1,200 job openings in North Dakota. And they're having some trouble in parts of the state filling jobs. There were some in western North Dakota, some counties are at 50% of quota in terms of filling the jobs. In the east, it's a little bit better. But, you know, they're paying pretty good money for this part-time job.
Well, they are. But, of course, the state has this chronic and in places acute labor shortage. And
correct.
Now we're adding another, 1,200 and some mm-hmm. to a 30,000-person deficit by some
right.
estimates.
And you're talking about that is a real exacerbation of the whole situation with jobs in North Dakota.
But, again, as you mentioned, these are good-paying jobs. So
they are.
You know, they don't last forever, but they are good.
It's really important. And you even had that in the Native American voting thing this week. They were saying, hey, we are going to focus on getting everyone counted, because in his State of the State address, Governor Burgum said that he wants to make sure everyone who is eligible to vote will be able to vote. The census is going to help that down the road.
This is interesting, because this is kind of a tension between the absolute imperative of counting every head in North Dakota, because there's federal money that flows
correct.
Because of that, and past sort of issues about, you know, making maybe an additional hurdle for some people in the state to vote.
Right, and the hurdle being not having a street address. Now there's a real effort, and we talked about this earlier, about the statewide 911 enhanced thing that's going on. That's helping to get some addresses on the reservations, and that will help people get a chance to vote. Now, at the same time, Secretary of State Al Jaeger has emergency rules that are going to be put in place in order to accept all forms of tribal ID. And they're going to be working to make that a permanent rule so that, you know, each tribal organization has different IDs and different requirements. The only thing that they require is a name, a birth date, and, of course, your street address.
Well, there's some other really important and interesting news about our indigenous populations,
yes.
and that is that the University of North Dakota is starting a brand new doctoral program in indigenous health care.
I think that's a response to what's happening. You know, the largest group of people in North Dakota, a growing population, is our indigenous people. And healthcare is a real concern, especially on the reservation. So I can understand why UND is doing that. And it's going to also help maybe attract some doctors, nurses, and other medical professionals to these underserved areas.
Well, Dr. Donald Warren, the director of the Indians into Medicine program at UND, was very proud of the fact that it's better late than never. I guess we talked about that.
Yeah, when it's the first of its kind in the country.
In the world, he thinks.
In the world, yes.
So this is pretty innovative, and it's about time.
It is, and that shows you the focus on serving the less than served people around our state.
Let's talk about the Legacy Fund, because that's been a big political football in recent legislative sessions. The state's got this big store of money, mm-hmm. billions of dollars from the oil extraction tax. What do we do with it? Do we save it? Do we reinvest it? Do we spend it on what?
Exactly. And that's the committee that's now looking at it. And as you might expect, there are 141 legislators and probably more than 141 different ideas. But there seems to be some coalescing around the ideas that they ought to take some of the proceeds from the Legacy Fund, the earnings, and invest it back into the fund. The governor's talking about half of it being invested. Senator Wardner from Dickinson, the Senate Majority Leader, is talking about 40%. And there are some who are talking maybe taking 75% of the money and putting it back into the fund. So that will be a discussion. Also, what are the other things you're going to do with the money? A lot of demand for infrastructure, a lot of demand for water projects. There's a lot of demand out there for behavioral health. So there's going to be an awful lot of discussion in the upcoming session and going to be precipitated by what this committee is going to come up with.
Well, I was intrigued by the interest in reinvesting, because anybody who's been watching the stock market knows that it's been a pretty bull market
pretty
for quite a while
robust,
now.
Exactly.
And so there's, I suspect that raises interest in getting more interest out of the money.
Right. And then you had Governor Burgum in his State of the State address, and we're going back to that. He said that you look at the Norway Sovereign Wealth Fund, that's $1 trillion. And he says, you know, we're looking at the legacy fund to take care of our needs or to try to help take care of our needs when the oil is gone, when the natural gas is gone. And who knows when that's going to be. But he says maybe it's a good idea to invest up front.
Well, when you're talking about a nation of 5 million people like Norway with $1 trillion, it's almost like you're on automatic.
Pretty much, and
terms of funding your programs.
That used to be called the Norwegian Retirement Fund Global. And as the people in the Norwegian government would say, the retirement fund is a misnomer because it takes care of a lot of needs too. But that is all oil and gas driven because of all the North Sea drilling that comes off the coast of Norway.
Of course, they're not just taking a percentage like North Dakota is. The oil and gas industry is pretty much state-owned in Norway.
That's correct. Well, yeah, basically they call it Statoil.
Yeah, that's right. The Prairie Dog infrastructure money may be available earlier than predicted. You posted this story this week.
Right. Again, we're talking about oil and gas tax revenue. The collections are about 4% above normal. And instead of having probably the money available toward the end of the biennium, which would be like the end of June 2021, everybody is now predicting that the Prairie Dog money could be available as soon as the end of this calendar year. And if it is, there are a lot of cities, counties, and townships who are saying that's great because we have a 2021 construction season and maybe we can start using some of that money to get some of these roads, bridges, curbs, and gutters in place.
And I think they're interested in the infrastructure as opposed to just basically padding the property tax. Obviously, these infrastructure things are funded by property tax, but
right.
The idea being not to sort of artificially depress the property tax because then it so easily goes right back
there. That is correct, and that's another thing they're concerned about. There are a lot of balls up in the air right now. You know, they're juggling things to make sure all this thing financially will make sense. But I know the cities, counties, and townships really pushed hard for this Prairie Dog bill, and the governor has been a big supporter of Prairie Dog. And when he signed it, he said, oh, this dog is starting to dig, which I thought was pretty good.
All right. Well, let's talk about another issue that has been in the news quite a bit and will be again when the legislature convenes the next time, and that's to legalize recreational marijuana.
That's right.
An issue in North Dakota and in Minnesota right now.
Correct. And the Minnesota legislature is going to confront it head on. In North Dakota, it's an initiated measure. But then again, once that passes, there's going to be some legislation perhaps that's going to be taken a look at by the legislature to determine, you know, how are you going to regulate that. And the measure itself that's being circulated does have some restrictions in it. And remember, 2 years ago, it failed 60-40. And one of the reasons they said it failed was too broad. Well, the organizers are saying, we decided to narrow it down in terms of the amount of plants people can have and the amount of marijuana they can have on hand. And they said they've had some help from the legislative council and from some legislators and from some lawyers to see if they can get something that will pass. And they're assured that this will be on the ballot in November.
Well, the House Majority Leader in Minnesota, Ryan Winkler, has said that he is going to introduce a marijuana legalization bill.
Correct.
And the legislative session there starts about a week from now.
Correct. So that'll be one to watch. There's a lot of resistance in the Senate to that legalization bill. And there's a little side issue on that in Minnesota that we've discovered, and that's the idea that maybe there needs to be a rewrite of medical marijuana laws.
Yes.
So that could be interesting, too.
Okay. Well, let's move on to a little story here that's pretty good news for the North Dakota National Guard. Tuition assistance has been a good recruiting tool.
It has. Yet they're not quite at full staff. But remember, when this first came to be, they had to go to the Emergency Commission to say, we need more money because we're out of money. So they got some more money, and the legislature in 2019 approved more money. And General Dorman, who is our adjutant general, says it is a good recruiting tool. But he said something very interesting to me, which is in our story, if you take a look at our website, that it's not maybe the number one reason people join the Guard, but it is a nice little tool to attract people. The number one people want to join the Guard, the number one reason is that people want to give back. to North Dakota. So you can give back by becoming a member of the Guard.
It's a great form of service.
It is a very good form of service.
And let's finish with this record donation to the Great Plains Food Bank. Todd McDonald reported on
$80,000 from Hornbacher's Foods. Amazing. Yeah. And that could be the start of something big, because the Hornbacher's people are starting saying maybe we can even do more. But, you know, it's also a huge recognition of the need for these food banks to allow people who might be going hungry to have something.
We check in with our news director, Dave Thompson, every Friday. Always a pleasure, Dave.
Thank you, Doug.
The Minot Symphony Orchestra presents its annual family concert on Saturday, February 8th at 3 p.m. in MSU's Ann Nicole Nelson Hall. North Dakota Teacher of the Year Sarah Mendelin will narrate the remarkable Farkle McBride in his quest for the perfect instrument. Also, music from Copland, Tchaikovsky, Respighi, and Mozart's Violin Concerto, featuring the winner of the high school concerto competition, Victoria Hoverson, a homeschooled sophomore from Minot. The Minot Symphony on Saturday, February 8th at 3 p.m. Tickets are available at MinotSymphony.com or by phone at 701-858-4228.
Arts programming on Prairie Public is supported in part by the North Dakota Council on the Arts, a state agency developing, promoting, and supporting the arts in North Dakota.
It's time to go to the movies with Matt Olean. And Matt, this week you went to a movie that's biographical. It tells an important story of our history.
Harriet Tubman, who lived long time till 1913. She was 91, I believe, when she passed away. And we've been kind of waiting for a movie about her for a long time. We're still waiting for the $20 bills as well. Yeah. That's another story. But this film completed my viewing of all acting nominees for Sunday night's Oscars. Cynthia Erivo is nominated for Best Actress as Harriet Tubman, so I've seen them all now. I wanted to like this film a little better than I did. It's directed by Cassie Lemons, who is an African-American female director, and that's great to see that. She directed Eve's Bayou, which is probably her best film. This one I felt like she over-directed it. So, you know, it follows Harriet's escape from slavery, working on the Underground Railroad. She later commanded Union troops down in South Carolina. Just an amazing story. And she continued to go back and back and rescue other slaves before the Civil War began. So it's a fascinating story. It's just, I think it's overdone. There's wall-to-wall background music, Doug, and it's so overt that at some point I wanted it to back off. It almost felt like a TV movie in its style, its presentation, kind of like Roots, which now, you know, Roots was such a big deal at the time. But if you compare it to something like 12 Years a Slave along this genre, which is a much more artful and better film, it just doesn't hold up as well anymore. And I think Cassie Lemons needed to maybe be a little more subtle the way Steve McQueen did with 12 Years a Slave, which is such an artistic, interesting film. That being said, Cynthia Erivo is very good as Harriet Tubman. I have no problem with her being nominated. I wish they'd have gone a little more diverse with that category, and Awkwafina and Lupita Nyong'o might have gotten in. That would have been a really strong, diverse category. Cynthia Erivo is the only actor or actress of color nominated this year. She's very good in the part. Harriet Tubman was an astounding woman, 5 feet tall, and she did so much to help people. I just wish the film was a little less. It feels like it's pounding you. It's pounding you with the message.
Didactic.
A little didactic. And they almost turn her into Dirty Harriet. That's been one of the criticisms. She's almost like a modern action hero in some scenes. And, of course, there's always artistic license taken in film. But I have talked to a few people that I trust that kind of thought the same thing, that maybe back off a little bit on the whole turning her into kind of an Avengers type hero. And she did some amazing things, obviously. I just feel like the film needed to be a little more subtle, a little more artistic than it is.
Okay. And, of course, 12 Years a Slave was nominated for a slew of Oscars, mm-hmm. and won a Three of them, I think. So
yeah, Best Picture, and it's a great film. I think this is a solid film. I urge people to go see it to learn about Harriet Tubman because, again, I just think a lot of kids growing up have no idea who she was. She's an important person. Janelle Monáe is in the film. She's kind of the name person in the film. She plays a northern freed black who kind of takes in Harriet when Harriet escapes. But some of the scenes are really well done. Some of the action scenes are well done. The escape scenes, you feel kind of the pressure and the nerves that these people must have gone through when escaping. I mean, any wrong move and they're caught and that's it. Interestingly enough, I think that the interesting thing is Harriet's relationship to the plantation owner in Maryland where she grew up. That's interesting because they're sort of the same age. She sort of grew up, you know, with him, and she prayed for him as a boy when he was sick. That's another interesting aspect of the film, Doug, is her belief in God. She believes, and Harriet Tubman believes she saw visions and that God was kind of guiding her. So it's a very religious film as well, touching on that aspect of her life where she felt she was being guided by God's hand. But the relationship with her and the plantation owner who desperately wants to get her back when she escapes, that's very interesting how they confront each other eventually in the film.
It's also interesting that Maryland is where she escapes from because it's so close, of course, to the nation's capital and, frankly, to the North.
Yeah, so that's interesting. A lot of the films we see, you know, Gone with the Wind, 12 Years a Slave, take place in the further South. This is right on the border up by Maryland, which makes it quite interesting. Maryland was such a strange state heading into the Civil War. But again, not to belabor the point, I just wish the film would have trusted its audience enough to make a more artistic film. Cassie Lemons is a talented director. She got a very good performance out of Cynthia Erivo, who's actually British. But I just don't think it's quite the film it was set out to be.
Well, let's talk about the Academy Awards this Sunday. You've got some picks for us?
Yeah, so the acting awards, I think, are pretty much going to go toward as chalk, as they say in sports. Brad Pitt's going to win supporting actor for Once Upon a Time in Hollywood. Joaquin Phoenix looks to be making good speeches now after kind of a rambling, maybe inebriated speech at the Golden Globes. I think he's going to win for Joker.
He was big at the BAFTA.
He was big at the BAFTA. The SAG Awards, he gave a nice speech. Renee Zellweger, I think, is going to win her second Oscar for lead actress as Judy Garland. And I think Laura Dern is probably going to win for Marriage Story and supporting actress. I've been critical of that category. I think that really could have been a strong category, but they didn't nominate the right people, I think, to fill that out. What gets interesting, Doug, is how much momentum does 1917 have? It seems to have the momentum right now with the Producers Guild Award, Sam Mendes for director.
Cinematography has to go to Deakins.
Yes,
that's
a lock. But what I can't quite get my finger on is the picture director screenplay. I can see the big three films, and I think there's three great films this year: Parasite, Once Upon a Time in Hollywood, and 1917. My guess is 1917 is going to win picture. But because of how 1917 was shot with almost a continuous take, I can see them giving director to either Tarantino or Bong Joon-ho. So I'm going to predict I'm going to go out on a limb and say the Parasite director Bong Joon-ho wins director, but I think Tarantino gets another screenplay Oscar, which would be his third. I think he's going to be denied the director Oscar, but I'm going to say they spread the love around with picture director screenplay between those three movies. That's just a guess, though.
I think 1917, you know, Sam Mendes as the director and Richard Deakins as a cinematographer.
Yeah.
I don't downplay Mendes' role in that because that was an exceptional collaboration.
I don't downplay it either. It's a phenomenal motion picture. What I'm saying is I can see them spreading the love around because Parasite and Once Upon a Time in Hollywood are so close to being equal to 1917, in my opinion, in terms of great films that we look back on. I can see them spreading the wealth around. If Mendes gets director and picture, then it's going to be a big night for 1917.
All right. Well, we've been to the movies with Matt O'Lean.
After chaotic caucuses in Iowa, Democratic candidates look ahead to New Hampshire. and how a dialect coach helped one Irish actor talk American without a brogue.
When I get quite emotional, it'll come out more. But you see, maybe I shouldn't tell you that, because then everyone will know where I slipped up.
Saoirse Ronan and the latest news, Saturday on Weekend Edition from NPR News.
7 a.m. Central, right here on Prairie Public.
This is Dakota Datebook for February 7th. There's much interest in architectural preservation these days, so it's interesting that already back in 1923, there was concern about losing a historic building at the North Dakota Agricultural College in Fargo. The building was Francis Hall, the second building constructed on campus. It was built in 1893 at a cost of $17,000 and was named for O.W. Francis, a former president of the school's board of directors. It served as a dormitory, had a dining room, a reception area, and was also home to the Department of Domestic Economy. The building was converted into classrooms and laboratories in 1899. It housed labs for horticulture, veterinary science, agriculture, and household economics. In 1922, the college's administration wanted to add a new agricultural building, and they decided that Francis Hall was in the way. By early February of 1923, the Fargo Forum was reporting on a strong movement to save the building, writing, "Because of growing sentiment expressed by students, faculty, and alumni, Francis Hall, second oldest building on campus, will be moved, if it is possible to do so, intact to a new location 225 feet from its present site." The article continued, "Opposition to the raising of Francis Hall began as soon as the announcement was made that a new building would be erected. While the student body and alumni, as well as the faculty, expressed desire to see a new and much-needed building erected, they balked when they thought of the fate of Francis Hall. The Board of Administration called for bids to move the building, but it soon became apparent it would be far too expensive. Instead, they found another site for the new agricultural building." School President John Shepherd said, "Many pranks and stunts were played at Francis Hall." One story he told was of some pranksters bedding down a two-month-old calf in the dormitory bathroom for the matron, Mrs. Holderman, to discover. Shepherd said he never did learn how the beast got in there. In 1959, the North Dakota legislature appropriated $76,000 to renovate Francis Hall, but school president Fred Holtz convinced the 1961 legislature to instead demolish it. A portion of Francis Hall's location is now home to Holtz Hall, named for the man who pushed for the historic building's demise. Today's Dakota Datebook was written by Mary Helm. I'm Merrill Pepcorn.
Dakota Datebook is produced in cooperation with the State Historical Society of North Dakota, with funding from Humanities North Dakota.
Monday on Main Street, we'll hear what's in the works from Kim Conoco of the North Dakota Council on the Arts and Brenna Gerhart of Humanities North Dakota. The final episode of Antiques Roadshow's visit to Bonanzaville in West Fargo will air Monday night, and we'll have an excerpt from a behind-the-scenes special, and we'll talk about an upcoming elder financial abuse webinar. That's all coming up on Main Street on Monday. On our Sunday morning show at 10 Central, we'll hear from Grand Forks native Andrew Town. He was part of a six-man rowing crew that rowed the perilous Drake Passage to Antarctica and set several world records while they did it. And we'll also hear from Dr. David Warren, who helped start a new doctorate in Indigenous Health at the University of North Dakota, the first of its kind in the world. That's all coming up on Main Street. In the meantime, enjoy the rest of your day.